Welcome to the Lizzie Borden Podcast, episode 43.
The Lizzie Borden Podcast is sponsored by Belanger Books, featuring all new adventures of Sherlock Holmes, Solar Pons, Carnacki the Ghost Finder, and occult detectives from the pulp era to the 21st century. From Lovecraftian horror to the wondrous worlds of H.G. Wells, Belanger Books has it all. Visit them today at belangerbooks.com.
I am your host, Stephanie Corey, filling in for the late Richard Behrens, author of the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective series of mysteries. The Lizzie Borden Podcast is the only podcast entirely devoted to the study of the Borden murders of 1892, Lizzie Borden, and the world that shaped her, Fall River, Massachusetts, and beyond. Produced by Nine Muses Books and Anna Behrens, the podcast explores the many facets of the case, the crime, the culture, the courtroom drama, and Lizzie's lasting impact on popular imagination. In this episode, we interview Stephen Cheslick DeMeyer, who along with Alan Stevens Hewitt and Tim Maynor created the rock opera Lizzie, which is enjoying a worldwide production life from its humble beginnings as a 45-minute, four-song experimental musical created for the Tiny Mythic Theater Company in the 1990s. It has grown to be a nearly two-hour, four-woman show with a six-piece rock band that has quite the cult following. Stephen is a lyricist, musician, author, and artist who is currently writing a book that combines memoir, family lore, and 20th century queer history. He lives in New York City with his husband. You can read his blog at StephenCheslickDeMeyer.com. See the link below in the show notes. And now, the Lizzie Borden Podcast presents an interview with Stephen Cheslick DeMeyer. So welcome, Stephen. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Beautiful summer day.
It is, isn't it? Finally. So tell us a little bit about yourself in your own words. I'll have a link to your bio in the show notes, but I wanted to hear it from you, what you consider important about your life.
Well, the basic stuff is that I grew up in the Midwest in Indiana. I went to college for a couple of years and studied theater in Ohio. Got very impatient because from the time I was a young teenager, wanted to end up in New York and couldn't wait to finish college. So I applied to Parsons School of Design and I came to New York to study painting. I did that for a year and got impatient again and left art school because I wanted to be an artist in New York. I didn't want to be an art student anymore. Even though, I loved art school, I loved college, but I was living in the East Village. It was 1982. Things were very exciting and I just wanted to make work and, had very romantic ideas about what it was going to be like to be an artist in New York and in the 80s. And it actually kind of was. And when I look back, I think that sometimes I wonder if I over-romanticize it, but I don't know if it's possible to over-romanticize that time in New York. It was just there was so much going on in that neighborhood in terms of politics and art and theater and queer stuff. And I just, was eating it all up. So I dropped out of art school. I painted for a while, started playing in bands. My boyfriend at the time played in a couple bands. And so I had played cello when I was young. So I bought an old cello and I was never really very good. And I was even worse after not practicing for years. But it was a very DIY kind of time in our lives. So we played in a band. Actually, the album that we recorded back then that we could never release was just released by Sundays Records in Nashville just last year.
Oh, wow.
And actually sounds pretty good. When I revisit that stuff, it's like we were kind of onto something.
What was your group?
We were called The Woods. And it was my boyfriend and me and two women, a lesbian couple who were close friends of ours. So we all always sort of thought of ourselves as the ABBA of DIY experimental, pop in New York, even though we sounded nothing like ABBA. So then from there, I still always kind of had my eye on theater, wanted to do theater. My boyfriend was a bartender, and a woman that he worked with in a restaurant was just starting a theater company. And so she asked Brian if she knew that Brian and I wrote music together. And so she asked if we wanted to compose music for their first production in their first season of their company. They were called Tiny Mythic Theater Company, which went on to form Here Arts Center in New York, which still ongoing. So it was a production of Strindberg's Dream Play, and we wrote and performed, recorded, did sort of a hybrid of recording and performing the score for Dream Play, then did their next play. And after that, or I guess Kristen Marting, who was the director who of their of the one of the other founders of the company. I promise I'll get to an end point here
No,
soon. I'm
it's
gonna do
all very good. I'm
the whole story.
your story is real. Just tell it, man.
Okay, I will. Kristen was doing a production in their second season not of Dream Play, of what's the play? Blood Wedding, the Lorca play Blood Wedding, and asked if Brian and I wanted to compose for that. And by that time, Brian was really he was kind of over the long hours and no pay and the sort of grueling part of producing theater, downtown at that time in New York. And I was just loving it. I felt like I was really coming into my own as a songwriter and learning so much about writing for theater and, making friends with all these new people. And so I said, well, I'll just do it alone. And I did. And then Tim, now we get to Lizzie. Tim, one of the other
Maynard.
writers, Tim Maynor on Lizzie, was also one of the founding directors of that company. And the model of their company was that there were three directors and they would all direct production in the season, and then the other members would function as producers. So I worked with Tim as a producer, though, for that first year. But then he was directing the production of Drums in the Night, the Brecht play Drums in the Night. And there's only one song in that play, and the lyrics are in the play, but not the music. I think, I might be wrong, but I think that the original composer that he worked with on that
Veal.
was Kurt Weill. Yeah, so I think that's right. Or that may,
Yes, that I think you're
sometimes you
right.
go back and
No.
revise your memories. So I did that. I wrote that song. Tim and I became very close, started working together closely as artistic collaborators, and it was just a really natural fit, and we became friends. We were both at that time, by this time it was like 1988, 89, and we were both, strongly gravitating toward ACT UP and Queer Nation and all the queer politics that were happening in New York at that time. Wanted to do very political work, wanted to be involved in this project of taking American stories, which was what Tiny Mythic's sort of mission was, to work with, in a very broad sense, American stories. Tim was interested in that and interested, along with me, in the sort of queering of American stories, uncovering queer people in those stories who had not been disclosed at the time, or taking elements of those stories and making them queer, making the protagonist queer, just in a broad sense, working in that way. So around that time, Tiny Mythic was starting a theater festival, a summer festival called the American Living Room. And it was a summer-long festival where every Saturday night they would have three short works of theater together as a program. And so the only requirement was that you had to make something that could be loaded in, performed, and loaded out in an hour. And so, it was a very broad range of stuff, very experimental stuff to mostly kind of experimental stuff, but also, new plays by young playwrights in New York. So that first, I think it was that first year of the festival, Tim, just one night when we were sitting around at his apartment, talking about theater probably and politics, which we just kind of did incessantly, he said something about Lizzie Borden. And I don't remember exactly how the conversation went. People ask me this all the time,
Oh yeah.
but the idea, I mean, I think Tim had the idea in his head that he wanted to do something with Lizzie Borden. And as soon as he said that, I was like, oh my God, Lizzie Borden, like I'm obsessed with that 70s TV movie with
Oh,
Elizabeth McGovern. And he was like, I am too. And so it just like took off from there. And at the time I was going through a phase of being really into the Runaways and Joan Jett and Lita Ford. Always loved Heart, always loved all those 70s, sort of, hard rock bands with women vocalists, women writers. So the music just kind of naturally came. So now I've told you the whole Lizzie Borden story, and you just asked about me. But I mean, that was the genesis of it. And that's, the kind of the beginning of our friendship was that, the writing of that show.
And that was what, 2000, 1994 or something like that?
No, that was 1990.
Oh, wow.
It's interesting because the people, like in different contexts, and when different people tell the story or refer to it, they, say that the piece premiered in 1990, or they say 1994, or they say 2009, and all those things actually are really true. The original, sort of first iteration of it was only, I don't know, 40 minutes long, if that, and it was four songs. It was very rough, very experimental. We felt no obligation to tell a story because we assumed an audience that would know it in the way that we did. We grew up with that TV movie, and it was just kind of a, and the nursery, the jump rope rhyme, like everybody kind of knew the general outline. So we didn't care, and we took a lot of stuff from the trial transcripts. There was a whole section that was not musical. It was sort of a some kind of iteration of the trial. And we took a lot of stuff from the trial transcripts and used them in the songs, and that stuff still persists. But it started with the murder. The first thing that happened was an axe lowered from the ceiling, and she grabbed it and hacked him to death. So it was very different. But the seed of it was there. Bridget was a non-singing role in that first one, which is, I mean, it's hard to even
Hard to,
imagine.
yeah, completely hard to imagine.
But the desire, the love affair, I mean, if you can call it that, between Lizzie and Alice was a big part of that very early one. And there was a big song at the end called "Where Are You, Lizzie," which was Alice alone on stage after Lizzie had been acquitted and took off, lamenting her, who, where am I now that you're off free and here I am. So then in 1994, here was sort of more had was sort of more established downtown, and decided that they wanted to bring the show back. By that time, I was doing Y'all. So I
Which
was on.
is y'all is your group, right? Your other group.
Yeah, Y'all was my, this was a, this was a, I was always collaborating with boyfriends back then. Jay Bird, who was my partner for 10 years, and we were partners in life, and also created this thing called Y'all, which was a duo where we played these sort of fictionalized versions of ourselves. And it was kind of hillbilly music with a sort of Grand Ole Opry kind of sensibility about the presentation. It's a little hard to describe. Like
Like a
it's,
hee-haw-ish kind
yeah,
of.
very inspired by that.
Yeah.
But also, we were obviously this gay couple on stage singing about our life together. And then from there, started playing in folk venues, started touring the kind of Northeast, coffee house, house concert, folky scene. Did a lot of that, played in rock clubs, played in churches. We eventually ended up leaving New York and moving to Nashville in 98. And then from there, bought a camper and just took to the road permanently, lived on the road for 2 years. And then at the end of that was, kind of the disintegration of the relationship and the act. But it was a great 10 years, and it took us to a lot of places.
Oh, see,
So
it's life is like crazy, isn't it? It's
it's
just,
insane.
it's insane where you end up and then how that, like for them to say to you, oh, we want to revisit Lizzie Borden. Like, will you do it for us? And like unexpectedly that happens. And then when I saw it, must have been in 2009.
2009.
In New York, off Broadway. I was like, there were three of you, right? There was you and there was Tim.
And Alan. Alan Steven Hewitt. He came on in 2000, well, a couple of years before 2009. That was, you know, we did that 94 production. We added a few songs. It was longer, but then, it, you know, kind of put it to bed. And, you know, it was a great memory, but it was downtown. It was a short run. And then, you know, in 2009, many years later, I was living in Texas then. And our friend Pete McCabe, someone Tim had gone to school with, he and his girlfriend, who was a law student at the time, saw the 94 production and really loved it and just never forgot it. And she just felt certain that it, you know, it needed to be, needed support and needed to be brought back. So, and by 2009, she, you know, she had started her own law firm, which became wildly successful. She had some money and said, I'm going to option this thing. And we had this, you know, amazing couple of years where they supported us through this process of, you know, Tim and I went on an artist retreat for a week and wrote a whole new batch of songs and then started doing workshops and readings. I was in Texas, so I, you know, was kind of coming back and forth to New York, but it was too much. And I felt like the show was getting bigger and it was reaching this point where we needed someone with a whole new musical skill set to collaborate with. Because at that time I was still, you know, I don't write music. I mean, I sort of understand what notation is, but I don't really do it. So we were working, you know, I was working with other musicians and working with demos, and it, you know, it was great, but we really wanted someone who could work without me being there. And I knew Alan from, Alan was in a band that, you know, y'all had done some shows with and we'd become friends. And I just knew he was perfect. You know, he, from a really young age, had a classical background and a rock, like punk. He played in punk bands when he was a young kid and had played in rock bands. That's where I met him. So he had this kind of like match of skills, really, you know, incredibly talented guy. So I, you know, contacted him and said, you know, during this thing, it's coming back. I need somebody who can music direct these workshops and this production. So he came in and just like immediately started kind of tinkering with songs and writing some new stuff and, you know, doing these arrangements. And it, that grew into this kind of full collaboration, you know, where he, we went back and rewrote some songs together, co-wrote some songs, you know, fresh. He wrote a song. He wrote This Is Not Love. I think that was even added after you saw it.
Mm-hmm.
So just, you know, the three of us became this really fruitful kind of group at that time in 2009.
So what is this show about and what is its format?
Its format, as it exists now, it has had sort of a long evolution, but now it's a rock musical. You know, sometimes we call it a rock opera. I think Alan prefers the term rock opera, and it is, it sort of is that in a way. It's some, maybe somewhere in between.
The name?
But the name is Lizzie. The name has become shorter over the years too. But it, for a long time, it was Lizzie Borden because we felt like we had to trade on that name recognition.
Right.
But then we realized that we didn't really need to. Like, people got it. You know, either people knew that story or they didn't. And we, you know, we, if they didn't, we were going to tell the story. So Lizzie was just punchier and everybody wanted to call it that anyway.
I still have my t-shirt.
Yeah.
That I bought.
It was called Lizzie Borden then, right?
Yeah.
Does it say, yeah.
No, I think it was called Lizzie Live. Is that right?
Was it?
Oh, I'll have to look.
I know.
I'll have to look at my t-shirt. I know she's dressed punk.
Yeah.
And she's got a hatchet or an axe in her hand.
Yeah. I remember that t-shirt.
Of course I had to buy a t-shirt. So this is it's all music, making it an opera. So there's no like dialogue, except the dialogue is sung.
Yeah, well, there's some dialogue, but very little.
And how many characters?
There are four characters. We decided that we wanted to tell the story after reading the, you know, doing all our research and reading all the inquest testimony. We really felt like it was a story about four women in a house. We made the only characters Lizzie, her older sister Emma, Alice Russell, who's a neighbor and a good friend, and Bridget, their maid, who also lived in the house. So yeah, four characters, and then they are backed by a rock band in the current, conception of it. It's a six-piece rock band, and the kind of idea is that it's these four women fronting a band. I mean, that's not literal, but that's the sense, the sort of sense we want to convey on the stage.
And it's the characters are expressed through music, like musicals are. Even Rodgers and Hammerstein did that. So the interesting part is the differences between the characters themselves. They're all very different from one another, different in age, different in dress, different in the kinds of songs they sing and the kinds of stories they tell. Bridget is a particular presence. Can you describe, how would you describe Bridget?
She is, well, she, you know, in the historically, she's the Irish maid. So, she's a young woman, an immigrant who lives in the Borden household. And you get the sense in her testimony that she's, fairly put upon. She doesn't have a warm relationship, particularly with Lizzie and Emma, who you get the feeling she thinks of them as, these kind of entitled girls who boss her around.
Which is true.
Which is true. And, they even she says that they would often call her Maggie, which wasn't her name, it's the name of the previous maid, I guess.
Oh no, it was actually, it turns out that that was a common name that people called their Irish domestics.
So just like a,
The My
you call
Maggie.
my
Yeah,
Maggie.
it was a Fall River thing, and it was
So
very
patronizing.
common. It wasn't meant to make the person into the other again. It wasn't meant to make them, to insult them. It was just offhand because Bridget Sullivan is like one of the most common Irish names on the planet. And so they didn't refer to people that worked for them necessarily by their first name, but all Irish domestics were called Maggies.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, so I didn't know that until Michael Martins from the Historical Society told me, because I thought it was an insult. I thought it was, I'm not even gonna learn your name, but it's not that at all.
That's how
So,
we do
yeah, that's how we do it, right? I'm gonna insult you this way. So,
Yeah.
but
But
she's intense.
she's intense. I mean, I think that comes from, we wanted to cross that sort of, portrayal of Bridget with this sort of banshee mythology
Yes.
of, the banshee comes to wail at the door of someone who's going to die or someone who has died. And the banshee is this kind of terrifying domestic spirit. So it just seemed like that was a way to make Bridget a kind of a narrator, not really a narrator,
Well,
but
sort
she's the
of,
one who
yeah.
makes a connection with the audience.
Well, see, with Bridget, there's one thing that I've always thought. That she never told anybody what was going on. She never spilled any gossip about the relationship in that family with anybody to anyone. She kept it all private, but she had to have seen everything. She had to know who got along with who, what kind of fights they had, because she's the invisible person that lives in the house that nobody acknowledges, but she's present for everything. And so she knew all of it, but she never was asked about it and she never told. So you create this character that she does hear everything. She does know everything. And
And
she,
knows everything in advance often.
right. So, I mean, that's just, I think the reality, that's a reality thing for Bridget that she never is presented that way in history because there's no evidence that she ever told anybody. I mean, even her own family didn't know she was that Bridget Sullivan. So she never talked about it. Isn't that
And I
weird?
think
Can you imagine like living into the 1940s and you never mentioned that that was a part of your life?
Yeah, and I think, mainly attributable to just an adherence to these social norms, like that just you just didn't do that, that there was
Do
some
you
kind
think
of
that's it?
transgression. Feels like that to me.
I don't
Or
know, because
maybe
at that point, everybody's dead. So what's the point of keeping it a secret all this time? Like, I don't get that part. She just didn't want to bring the newspapers to her front door, I think. She didn't want to be an object of attention. That's my
Well,
guess.
I also wonder if part of that not wanting to be an object of attention was not wanting to be a suspect. I mean, because it seems to me, and the part of the reason that we wanted to confine the story to these four women is that, like, I always felt like all of them must have known whatever happened in that house. They must have all known. How could they not? The way that the architecture of the house, how close, how they were, there are these timelines of people witnessing certain things at certain times that just make it impossible for that crime to have been concealed
Right.
from the people who lived in the house if it
Right.
wasn't one of them.
And the
I
stories
think
that
that.
are told are like, oh, we have Lizzie and Bridget's say so, but the other two people are dead. So we have that's all the that's all we know is what they say, and it's unreliable just because of who they are and what happened. So all of it's like imaginary things, and they stuck to their stories.
Which is why I think it's such a why the story has persisted, why people are still so fascinated by it, is because it really is truly this sort of unsolved and unsolvable
It
crime.
is
Like
unsolvable.
you just there it's like the farther, the more you know, the more you think like nobody could have done this.
Right.
Like, there's no
There's a book that does that. The book that came out right after the murders, by the man who got turned, it turned out he was a minister in Rhode Island, and he wrote a book about it. And in it, he says, well, then no one did it. Because if Lizzie didn't do it and she was acquitted, then no one did. So it never happened. It's basically his argument.
And there's this there's this idea that like there were never any other suspects, which people sort of interpret to mean like, well, of course Lizzie did it, but the reason there are no other suspects is because there's no other way to tie anyone to the crime, not even Lizzie.
Right.
There's just like
There's no evidence of any of it.
everyone has some alibi,
Right.
alibi or someone testifying that they, saw them in these certain places at certain times. It's a crazy story.
And the fact that she's female and there's the death penalty that's attached to this crime. So, oh my gosh, a bunch of men sitting around going, well, if we convict her, she's gonna hang. Do we really want to do that? You know? And so, and there had been a murder with an axe the next year, right before the jury was sequestered, the Bertha Manchester murder. So we don't know if the jury heard about the murder, but they certainly didn't hear about the arrest of Jose Correa and his conviction and his admitting that he did it and going to jail, because that was in the 13, 14 days of the trial. So they had heard there was another murder. So who's to say they weren't like, hey, you know? Obviously, she didn't do it because there was another axe murder in Fall River. You know, they never said if that affected them.
But if it was like some maniac just came in the house and killed them, like why wouldn't they turn the maniac in? Like obviously they were
No
there.
kidding, no kidding. Yeah, or the what is it, the illegitimate son. Yeah, Lizzie's gonna take the fall for her husband, for her father's bastard son. Why? Conspiracy theories galore. That makes no sense at all. But, you know, it's a locked door mystery. How? Emma's not there.
Emma's gone.
John Morse
She's
is not
not.
there.
Emma's in Maplecroft. I don't know. I don't know what happened.
Alice is nearby, though. I never thought of that. No, she is. She was, yeah, she was around the corner. She used to live next door, so she knew the house. But the whole thing with Lizzie the night before, she's like, oh, Alice, something bad is about to happen. I have a premonition. And it's like, who does that? Like, if you're the killer, do you actually go the night before and tell your friend something bad's going to happen tomorrow? Like, that doesn't even make any sense.
It's so weird and intense and spooky, that whole scene. There's so much stuff, you know, there's so much inquest testimony and trial testimony, as you know, because you manage all that stuff. But like, you know, back when we originally did our research, it would, you know, was of course pre-internet and pre-your website. But we, you know, I remember, you know, days and days at the Brooklyn Public Library. There was I don't remember how it was published in volumes, all that testimony. I can't remember who published that, but you know, standing there at the copy machine, I still have my, you know, stack of copies of all that testimony highlighted.
And now it's all free to download on the.
Now it'd be easy.
There used to be in Massachusetts, the trial transcript was held by the Superior Court, and you actually had to write the Supreme Court of Massachusetts to get permission to buy microfilm from the Boston Public Library where it was held.
Wow.
That's how it happened. And then, yeah. So it was finally transcribed.
Yeah. It's amazing stuff. You know, that research, you know, it's still such
a part. You did it the hard way. You absolutely did it the hard way. It was not like click, oh, I've got it. It was sitting down in a library. And that's amazing to me, like in the early years of people doing research on Lizzie Borden, how it all had to be done by hand, by foot, by car, by bus, by train. You had to like physically go places, and you had to sit in research areas and look at things or talk to city clerks or go to cemeteries. And it's not like that anymore. It's not like that anymore at all. I mean, newspapers are online, right?
Yeah. And you can, you know, download a whole, you know, download a 300-page transcript in a PDF. Mm-hmm. And then you have it on your computer, and it's very different from like standing at a Xerox machine, turning pages and actually having an encounter with every single page.
See, that's part of it, right? That's part of it, the encounter. And then the play becomes the musical. I still think of it as a story because it does tell a story, but it becomes it has a life of its own. And that's one of the things I want to circle back to, which is the fact that it exists and it actually has a cult following. I think it's the people who have seen it, know it, love it. Like, I don't know anybody who said, oh, that's a terrible piece of theater. You know, I don't know anybody who said anything like that. Cause it's mesmerizing. It is completely hypnotizing it's unusual in all the right ways, you know?
Thank you.
It's true.
I mean, it is this kind of like steamroller, you know, the way we've made it, you know, it starts out intense and it just does not let up.
Nope.
And there's this horrible, grisly murder at the end of the first act. And then, you know, it's only, I mean, it's, you know, the whole, in totality, it's less than 2 hours, but we almost feel like, I mean, there's an intermission in there, partly because, you know, most productions have like quite a bit of blood to clean up. But also because I think the audience just needs to breathe, like the, you know, it's like a gunshot right to those murders at the end of the first act.
Yeah. So I see this. I think I was with Jill Dalton, the actress / she's now a podcaster. She's an author as well. We came because I would always go stay with her in New York for free and then do stuff. So we came down to see your show because she was doing a Lizzie Borden live production that she had written, a one-woman show where she plays Lizzie in Maplecroft after Emma has left. Mm-hmm. And we sat there in the theater, and I don't even remember where it was. I just was profoundly affected by the show because even though I could say, oh, I know everything about this case, blah, 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 it was a whole new experience for me because it was so different than what I expected it to be. And it was also so perfectly done. So, like you mentioned, it's the Lizzie Borden story, but it's there's a demarcation between the first part of the show and the last part of the show. So it looks like a half and half. And things happen that are like, what? Wow. It's kind of like that all the way through. What? Wow. And the relationship that you created with Alice Russell, I thought was a stroke of genius. Mm. It was, let me be clear, that you have Alice Russell in love with Lizzie Borden. And that's the lesbian part of the relationship. Whereas Lizzie is not specifically a lesbian, but an opportunist who sees this attraction that Alice has for her and takes advantage of it in a kind of a so maniacal way to further her own interests and her own wants and needs. I just thought it was sort of this extremely brilliant relationship that you had built that I had never noticed before. And what's weird about that is that Alice Russell becomes the person that ends up getting in life, gets Lizzie indicted because she's like, goes to the grand jury and says she burned the dress. And they're like, what? Okay, you should, you know, indict this woman. After that became what she was later known as her turncoat friend because she never spoke to her again, because it was because of Alice that this came tumbling down upon her head. But Alice had asked the Lizzie and Emma, I have to go tell the police what you just did. And they said, do what you have to do. I mean, they sanctioned it. They approved the fact that she had to go to the police. And yet they never forgave her for it because of the consequences. But turning Alice into this sort of really major character was luscious. It was juicy. It was, like I said, unexpected and quite perfect.
Both Tim and I kind of zeroed in on that, the dynamics of that right away, just from reading the inquest testimony. That, I mean, you know, in real life, Alice is, what, like 10 or 15 years older than Lizzie? She's more.
She's Emma's age. Yeah. She's
Emma's friend.
Yeah.
But we just loved that Alice feels like the sort of moral core of the story. Like she's the one who she can't lie about it. And she eventually, you know, realizes like, I saw this thing. And to not disclose that to the police would be a lie. I don't know if this comes completely from this, but we, Tim especially, but both of us were very taken with the Victorian Lincoln book, The Private Disgrace, which is sort of all about the really like the town rumors and the salacious, the hints at, you know, weird stuff.
I didn't know her, but I knew her, right?
Yeah, it's very fun. I think that had a big influence on the kind of tone of the piece in the beginning.
I see. I can see that. I can really see that.
But, you know, we just loved that detail and making the, I mean, there were lesbian rumors, you know, about Lizzie, but they mostly, I mean, you know more in detail than I do, I'm sure, but mostly associated with Bridget. If there were rumors, they seemed to be about Bridget.
Well, they were about Lizzie and Nance O'Neill later. Not like Lizzie and Bridget during that period of time, but other authors or other, like, I think it started with Ed McBain. You know, he's the guy who wrote the book with the lesbian relationship. That's where it started. So, you know, leave it to him. He did that. He created this relationship. And I asked him about it once when I interviewed him. Where'd you come up with that idea? And he's like, sex sells, baby. And he says that, he's like, that was the sole reason why he invented it, was because it was going to sell. The book was going to sell. And then, of course, I don't know. I think people made her lesbian later as an otherness, as a bad thing, not mm-hmm. as a natural, normal thing. So
yeah.
That's where I was like, wait, you have no evidence of this. And you're saying that this makes her dangerous.
Yes.
And yes. There's where I had the problem, which is similarly, I hate demonizing the victims. I hate making Andrew and Abby into being horrible people or mm-hmm. having some incestuous thing going on, because to me, you have no evidence and you're just saying that because you make them deservedly killed instead mm-hmm. of victims. Like, nobody deserves to be killed this way.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you say that, because we, you know, very, very intentionally did not make Mr. and Mrs. Warden even characters in the show.
Right, right.
Because we thought, you know, if they're like real people on that stage, they're not going to sympathize with Lizzie. And Lizzie was the hero of our story. So, you know, they were just these sort of abstract, you know, and they were just like mean people. I mean, we really leaned into that sort of like that sort of rumor and innuendo about you know, him being sexual molestation mm-hmm. and the him being a miser who was, you know, cheating right. them of their money. The whole thing about the will, you know, he was going to leave his money to, you know, to Abby, and, you know,
the old
leave
folks
his daughters with
yeah.
nothing. And,
yeah.
But, you know, they also, you know, they were spinsters. And, you know, in 1892, so like a really easy way to explain that is that they were lesbians, or that Lizzie was a lesbian. You know, those kinds of like suggestions were made, you know, pretty commonly about, or
but yet there were no men of marrying men because the Civil War had wiped them all out. So
yeah.
there was a whole generation of women who never married, and they might have had a Boston, what do they call that? A Boston marriage?
Boston marriage. Yeah.
Yeah. But Nance O'Neill wasn't gay. She was an opportunist. She saw a dollar where she saw a dollar, and she mm-hmm. and Rankin needed funding for their theater company, and she, mm-hmm. Lizzie was rich, so
she got the money.
She got the money because she paid attention to her, and then Lizzie gets kind of labeled as having a relationship with Nance when it didn't happen, as far as we know. So it's in the real world, I have a problem with that. But in theater, yeah. I'll have any problem with that at all, because the play that you guys created, the musical, the rock musical, it makes sense, it works, it's interesting, and it's complete in and of itself. It does its thing. And you can't argue with that, because you're creating art. You're not creating nonfiction. You're not doing a documentary play. I mean, for gosh sakes, listen to Bridget sing some of those songs. I mean, she's violent, you know, just in the way she views the world.
Yeah, it's dark.
It is dark, but she has a right to be dark, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we were interested in the myth, you know, and sort of, I mean, it is this kind of American myth because of the jump rope rhyme, and mm-hmm. but we were interested in making that kind of American mythology. Lizzie Borden, as far as, you know, anyone knows now, is a, you know, young woman in New England who murdered her parents because they were horrible to her and she needed to escape. And that, to us, you know, completely rhymed with this sort of rock and roll story mm-hmm. of, you know, like rejecting your parents' generation in order to come into your own and flourish. So, you know, we wanted to turn Lizzie into this rock and roll god. That was the whole you know, arc of the story for us. Lizzie's apotheosis at the end as a hero.
In the first half, everybody's dressed period. You know, mm-hmm. even though the music isn't, they're dressed. The yellow dress on Alice Russell, I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that dress. And then, like, after you know, you come back from the from the intermission, it's different. They are punk. They are, they're themselves.
Yeah, what's so amazing with all these productions is watching all these young women sort of like, you know, take that on, you know, that transformation to play those roles and just to really be like free by the end of it. It's you know, it's pretty moving.
That's one of the things I wanted to mention to you, because, you know, I saw that production. You did a original cast album, right, that people can still...
We did. It wasn't a cast album because there was no production associated with it, but it was a studio album of the score. So some of those women on the album had played those roles in productions. Carrie Sima, who did Bridget in several productions, is on that. But it's not, you know, it's a studio album of the music.
But the production didn't go to Broadway. Like, I always like, this is going to Broadway. This is like going to be a big hit. And then, but it has a life of its own. It's probably paying the bills still. So was that unexpected, or was that the plan all along to have this be like something that people could do regionally or at colleges, or, you know, and they just, you know, lease the rights to do it, including the music, and put on these productions? Was that the plan all along, or did it just work out that way?
There was really no plan, to be honest. I mean, it's just, you know, we were, as it became sort of, you know, bigger and bigger productions, and then, you know, that 2009 production that led us to NAMPT, the National Alliance for Musical Theater, which is an organization that does, you know, it's a huge organization of regional theater producers and industry people, and they have a convention every year and they showcase a handful of shows, and they invited us to showcase in 2010, and everything kind of exploded from there. We just got lots of producer interest, lots of regional interest, and started working with a couple of independent producers, and that led us to another workshop in Issaquah, Washington, just outside of Seattle, like a New Works Festival, which, you know, further expanded our reach. And then we did had a Danish production. The Danish production came out of that. Vicky Bussert, who we've worked with many times as a director, she leads the musical theater program at Oberlin now, and previously was at Baldwin Wallace in Cleveland. She's directed it with her students many times. So things just got bigger and bigger from that 2009 production. And we've kind of just followed it where it's gone. You know, at that time, you know, when we sort of entered that more professionalized world, and, you know, up until then, you know, Tim directed the 2009 production and no one else had directed it before then, because it was really, before then, was like a piece of devised theater. More than a musical that you would, you know, just hand to somebody and let them do. But it became that, you know, out of that experience. So, you know, we're in this world where Broadway is kind of the end point. And so suddenly it was like, you know, that was on our minds, you know, after being in kind of more a downtown world before that. You know, it's just like you try to get producers interested, and, you know, you see what they want to do, and hope that that leads to something else, We want to do Broadway. We had a production that, you know, kind of almost got there. And, oh, when was that? It comes up in my Facebook memories to, you know, punch me in the stomach.
I hate those Facebook memories.
It's good and bad, that whole thing. Mm-hmm. But there were some commercial producers who put together, an off-Broadway production that was, you know, the idea was to do it off Broadway, and then it was going to go to Broadway. Mm-hmm. But it just all kind of collapsed right before the off Broadway production opened. You know, Broadway's just, it's a tough nut, you know.
Oh, it's terrible. Theaters. And it's super expensive just to even rent the theaters. And
Crazy. I mean, I think it would be great on Broadway. I think it would do great. Yeah. There are a lot of the sort of smaller Broadway houses that are just, it's the play is made for that kind of a space. So, you know.
The roundabout, right? I mean, that's a nice little space, a nice small place. Even theater in the
beforehand.
round, even the circle in the square, I don't even see why not. I mean,
There's a
it seems like it could be a black box kind of situation or a, you know,
totally. There's a
360.
production in Barcelona that they did. They staged it a couple, I think, a couple years in a row. I didn't get to go see it, but Alan went, and it's in the round in a more of a so kind of a large black box theater. Yeah, I think it's so flexible,
It really
and it's
is.
small. You know, it's a cast of four women and a rock band. It's been incredible. We've had six. It's in, you know, been translated into six languages
That's the
all over the
question I want to
world.
ask you about translation. Who does the translations? Do you guys do the translations, or is it done by the company and then you authorize it? I mean, what is the process legally even about that?
It's a collaborative process. I mean, the sort of general way it works is that the company will hire a translator, and then they do a translation, and then they do a back translation into English, like a literal, you know,
Right.
almost like Google Translation style translation. And then we vet that just mainly for content, which was very jarring at first to read those first couple because it's the language is just awful. You know, it's like all of our kind of finely honed lyrical language just like turns into mud. But you're just reading it to make sure all the images are correct, to make sure the facts are correct. And then you go back and forth from that and make sure everything lands in this sort of literal English sense. And you just hope, you know, that they're always like people that, you know, the company trusts, and we have, you know, lots of conversations, and it's always, you know, their intention is to bring our English thing into another language, which must be like incredibly challenging. But
Did you
but
say there were
then you
six of them?
there's
Six.
six.
What
It's
are they? French?
not French yet.
Oh, it would be
I'm
perfect in
surprised.
French. I think that would be
Totally.
a great French play.
Not French or Spanish or Italian, which is
So they
surprising to
did
me.
it in English in Spain.
They did it in Catalan.
Oh.
Yeah, because they speak Catalan in Barcelona.
How about the Danish production? Was it in?
That was in Danish. That was the first one. And then also Swedish, Hungarian.
Ooh. Ooh, that sounds like it would translate well.
And then Korean and Chinese. There's a production that's touring in China now, has been. I mean, they did a production that ran for quite a long time in Shanghai, and now it's touring China. That's the most like sort of mysterious,
Yeah, you and Arthur
frustrating.
Miller, right? Doing Death of a Salesman in China, doing Lizzie Borden in China. That must be amazing.
It's like hard, you know, we only see like little clips on social media, but there's not, you know, they're like just because of the, you know, I guess there's censorship issues, you know, there's very
Oh,
little even social
sure.
media contact. We're getting the play by the censors was a really interesting process because one company wanted to license it and the censors rejected it. Not because there's a lesbian love story, but because Lizzie gets away with it because they're very concerned with, you know, hierarchy and
Morality,
authority. And so, but then this other company a couple of years later said, you know, I think we can present it in a way that, you know, pleases the censors. And they did. They had some kind of a sort of, I don't know, text on the stage or some kind of epilogue, you know, short explanation at the end saying that Lizzie got away with it. She was acquitted because of the flawed justice system in America.
Ah,
Something
so
to that effect.
that made them very happy to say that because I can slam American justice as well as like justify the ending of the play. Oh, that's all right.
But they were, you know, we had lots of conversations with the company doing it in Shanghai, and it was so interesting to talk to them because they're very, you know, they all had, you know, command of English, understood the play, were very committed, you know, intelligent about the subject matter and you know, and really easy to talk to just as artists talking to each other, which of course that's what it is, you know, that's
Really,
it should
really.
be. But it was, you think of China as this sort of just mysterious place where you just don't know what the hell's going on.
Exactly. Like you don't even know what you're eating.
Yes, right. It was wonderful to make that connection, you know, with this group of artists who just like they loved our play and they wanted to do it.
You guys went to Japan, right, for the premiere there? You actually
Not
went
good
there?
to Korea.
Oh, it was Korea. Okay.
It hasn't been done in Japan yet. Another country that I think, like, why not? You know,
Oh,
it's
yeah.
really,
Oh, my gosh. It's exactly the kind of lightning bolt that they
yeah.
do anyway, you know? The
This
kind of.
company in Korea did it, and there's a lot of cross-fertilization between the Japanese theater, musical theater community and Korea. A lot of performers do both. We're still hoping to make that connection, but this
How many
company in
places have
Korea.
you been to see those shows? I mean, I'm sure you've seen them, but where did you get to travel to?
We did go to Denmark. We went to Denmark twice because they did the show a couple times, and they brought us to Korea twice. Their first outing with it was 2020, and there were all the travel restrictions of the pandemic, and the
Oh,
production
yeah.
was seriously curtailed, so we didn't make it to that one. And then in 2022, there were still pandemic restrictions, but they lifted them right in the middle of their run. So they kind of rushed and brought us out there in 2022, and then again in 2024, and then they're going to bring it back next year. This company in Korea, their model is to really like develop an audience for a show and then run it forever. Like they have a production of Hedwig that they've had been running, I think, for like 15 years or something
No
like
way. Oh, that's
that. Yeah.
great.
And
Huh?
they're amazing. Their production values are super high, and it's their production's been the best.
So the productions themselves are worldwide, United States as well as foreign.
Yeah.
And the life of the play, has anybody tried to or asked, can I change this or eliminate this song, reorder the play? Or, I mean, do people ask, can I play it all with men instead of women? You know, has anybody asked for anything weird?
People do ask the, I mean, our sort of standard contract, we self-licensed for a few years, and then finally we turned it over to a licensing agent because it was just getting too big for us. But our standard contract says that they can't alter any of the text or any of the music. And I think the language is, you know, nearly that general. People have asked to do things, and they've changed things without asking. Both of those
Oh.
things have happened. You know, there's a broad range in the way that people, directors and companies sort of see the ethics of that
And respect it and
and
not
respect
respect
it.
it, right? That it becomes theirs because they're producing it, not
And with
realizing.
it's a tough question for us because the three of us sort of want to maintain this kind of, you know, feeling that the show's had from its genesis, where it's like it's a group of people making theater together, and it needs to be theirs in this sort of, you know, fundamental way. But at the same time, you know, we want this property, you know, not to be diluted in a way that it, you know, that it persists as a work of art that we created. So often, like, we'll find out that people have, you know, it's usually happens in smaller productions, college or community theater productions.
What'd they
Like a
do?
friend.
What'd they do?
Well, there was a production in one place where they had added. Well, this happens probably way more often than we know, but we know of a handful of times where people will add the Bordens, the parents, as character. Maybe, you know, probably not speaking characters, but people on stage, and that always feels like. Like that was such a conscious choice for us to not do that, that it feels like it just feels wrong.
It betrays the
But
whole intention of the show with them not being there. There's a
yeah,
reason.
for the most part, when we hear about stuff like that, it's like in order to do anything about it, we would have to, like, you know, send our agents and lawyers in there and shut it down. And it's like that feels wrong to us. You know, it just doesn't feel right. They've made a choice, even if they didn't really respect the language of the contract. Sometimes, you know, I mean, they're smaller companies. Maybe they don't even read the contract. Maybe they don't know how that works, really. We always try to have, you know, express a lot of, or not express, but extend a lot of generosity in those kinds of cases, unless it's like some huge profile, high profile thing, which has not happened.
But nobody's said, oh, I want to do a production with all men instead of women.
No one's asked that. We had a college production with a trans Lizzie, which looked fascinating and kind of wonderful. Well, I don't, you know, there's no language about that in the
That's what I was
licensing.
wondering.
I mean, it comes from this kind of the origin of the piece is this kind of queer sensibility and a sort of high drama, almost veering on camp kind of sensibility. And we've always thought that like somebody should do a drag version. Somebody should like really do that, like not joke about it, like just really do it. I think the three of us would be into that. It would be a conversation we'd want to have, but we don't. I don't think any of us have any strong ideas about casting, really non-traditional casting.
If anybody hasn't seen it, which I'm sure there's tons of people who haven't seen this show ever, like most of the world hasn't seen it, you have to like go physically into a theater, like you had to do your research and physically go to a library. You have to physically go to a theater to watch this, and it has to be playing nearby or somewhere where you can travel to. Do you have like a website or a source where all the productions are listed so people can see what's coming or where it's happening?
Well, I think the only way really to do that, to like keep up with, productions as they're added, is to follow our Instagram, which is at Lizzie Musical. At what? How do they do Instagram? Alan manages our Instagram. He's really great at it and keeps up with it. We do have a website. We stopped listing all the productions just because it became so many, and it was really hard for us to keep it up to date. And we hated that sometimes it would not be completely up to date. So yeah, Instagram is the best way to follow it. We've had like I think it's over 200 productions domestically now. A lot of college, a lot of high school, a lot of community theater, and regional theaters. It's just kind of at every level.
Wow. And then internationally, like
International.
these big productions that become, I don't know, like I would like to see it in another language without me even knowing the language or being able to speak it. I would love, because I know the story and I've seen it before, so I would like to hear the words coming out of other cultures' faces. You know what I mean? Like, so. You know, that would be really cool just in and of itself, just to follow that along. Are these things now, of course, filming live broadcasts or live shows is generally, not allowed in professional theater because of licensing. But are there filmed productions that are licensed that people can go see online or pay to see or?
No full productions. There's a ton of clips on YouTube of, all kinds of productions all over the place. But no full production. We would love it if, somebody could make that happen. Just some kind of live capture of one of the good productions. But yeah, like you say, it's a big licensing issue and no one
So the
is.
three of you have the licensing on the entire production?
We do, yeah.
Yeah, cool. So I hope it's paying the rent.
I have a joint income with my husband, so between the two of us, we get by.
Oh, and you have a blog. Tell us about your blog. I read your blog. It is fascinating and self revealing in every way, and so intimate in ways that are like it's a sharing, it's a generosity that you bring to your blog, I
Well,
think,
thank
for the
you.
readers. So tell us about your blog so that we can go there
My
and learn more about you.
blog is at stephencheslickdemeyer.com. It's my full name without the hyphen. Yeah, and I blog there. I think,
We'll put
regarding the.
the link in the show notes too, so people can click there and go straight to it.
Okay, good. That would be great. It's diaristic. I think I've realized that the older I've gotten, that like the more the more revealing you are, like often for me anyway, the better the writing is, and I'm also writing a book which has a it's a book about my grandfather, but also about me, and it has the same, it's more considered and more formal than my blog, but still the
It's called
same
Jack.
envelope. It's called Jack.
And you know, when I saw that, I have to confess that when I saw Jack, I'm like, "Oh, he's doing Jack the Ripper now."
Yeah, I did. For a while, I was writing about Larry Eiler. I don't know if you know him. He was a serial killer in the
Oh
that
yeah.
actually lived in my hometown in Indiana. He
Oh.
didn't quite work within the context of the book I'm writing now, but I
Yeah.
still want to write about him.
But you really could do a Jack the Ripper, the three of you. I would think that that would be like the same period, 1888. So it would be like the same kind of nasty
We
situation.
could recycle the
And
costumes,
all women and never show him.
Yeah,
Just the
because
women that he killed.
that's a really interesting take.
You can have it.
Hey, that's a really good idea, actually.
You can have it
We might
for
we'll probably
free.
yeah.
Hey, I'm hereby world. I give this idea to you.
I do have to say, though, getting back to research, is that the work that you do has been invaluable, and I don't know if we've ever properly expressed our gratitude for that, but the website that you keep, the scholarship that you do, and preserve all that stuff and compile it and keep it, and also continue to explore that story. It's very inspiring to us
Oh, thank you. I
and
just,
really
that's my
helpful.
father coming through who said, we need to all be on the same page. We all need to have the same access to the same material so we can talk about it at the same table. Because if I have the trial, but I don't share it with you, then I can say things about it that you are not privy to, that you will never be privy to because I'm hoarding information. So my thing is just let it. Just release it all. Anything I have is out there because otherwise we can't have an intelligent conversation. There's always somebody who's like sitting on a throne looking down at people saying, well, you don't understand.
I love that ethos, and I love that about. I mean, from a very young age, I've loved libraries and librarians, and it's like my first resource when I want to know something. That whole spirit of making all this stuff available to anybody
For free,
for
right?
free.
For
Yeah,
free. Yes, we
libraries
want to learn. Yeah.
librarians are our heroes.
Yes, I was a librarian for a long time. So, yeah, I
Yeah.
love libraries. Libraries are great. Oh, I want to thank you very much for joining me today. It was a blast and interesting. And it's always good to talk to you and to
Such a
reconnect after
pleasure.
all this time. I mean, it's
Yeah.
been, oh, 2009 to 2026. That's a long time.
That's a very long time. Wow.
Yeah, it's
Yeah.
a long time.
18 years. Yeah.
Let's
That's such a pleasure. So great. Thanks for doing this.
and let's not be 17 years between it again.
Yes. Yes. I would love that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you for listening to the Lizzie Borden Podcast, episode 43. We've been talking to Stephen Cheslick de Meyer about his collaboration on the musical Lizzie and its amazing transformation from a small experimental work to a full-length rock opera with productions around the world and across the United States. Find Richard Barron's Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Stories at Amazon.com and at LizzieBordenGirlDetective.com, where you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Listen to more Lizzie Borden podcasts on our website, or on Podbean, Audible, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, and YouTube. Please support this podcast through a subscription on Patreon. Thank you.